those folks who listen but who don't support the station. And in fact, we know that that's about 9 out of every 10 listeners don't support the radio station with their contributions. Whatever reason, if you've been listening for a while and have never made a contribution, it would be great if this time around you could change that. You could sign on, make a contribution, maybe at the basic membership level, which is $40 for the year, maybe more if you like, $75 or more. Now, that's up to you. The important thing is that we can count you as a member of this group we call the Friends of WILL. These are our financial supporters. And over time, it's grown year after year, and we just want to keep that number growing. And you can do that by calling 244-9455. 217 is the area code. And we have some volunteers who'll take the call and give you some basic information from you, and that'll be that. And you'll have the good feeling that comes with knowing that you are a supporter of WILL. So you can call. Also, we're encouraging people, if you like, maybe you're listening online or you do a lot of work online, you can pledge online. Go to our pledge address, and it's new this time around. It's willpledge.org, and you can make your contribution that way. Whatever way you do it, it's really important and will help us to make our goal that we've set for this week and then the overall goal of keeping WILL strong and keeping, maintaining the high level of programming that we have, these programs that we know you depend on. You want them to be there when you turn the radio on. Well, we want to be here too. But we can do that only if we hear from as many different people as possible who listen and who are willing to support the station with their dollars. 244-9455 is the number to call to make a pledge. Also, you can go online at willpledge.org. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will be doing something, from time to time on the show. One of the things that we like to do is to go back and to rediscover bits of history that may have been lost, or at least perhaps introduce you to events and places and people that you might not know about. And that is what we will do this morning in this part of Focus 5A. We will be talking a little bit about the history of what no doubt was one of the worst man-made disasters in the history of North America. It, in fact, is the history of the biggest, most damaging human-made explosion in history before the atomic bomb. And it happened in Canada. It happened in Halifax in Nova Scotia during World War II. During World War I, when two ships collided. One of them was loaded with explosives that was due to go to Europe for the war effort. And it devastated the city. We'll talk this morning with Laura McDonald. She has authored a book that explores this event. She is the author of several books. She's also written and produced award-winning television shows and one feature film. And her book is titled Curse of the Narrows, and it's published by Walker. It's in bookstores now, if you would like to take a look at it. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you want to be involved in the conversation, you can give us a call. Ms. McDonald, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, well, I'm pleased to be here.
You now live in New York, but you grew up in Halifax.
I certainly did.
And was this the kind of a thing that, as a girl growing up there, was this something that people talked about, thought about? I expect that it would have been something that everybody who lived in Halifax would have known, that this thing had happened.
It was. I remember the moment I learned about it. I was in school. And I was looking, I went home and I immediately looked out the window because we lived in a high hill overlooking the harbor, as many people in Halifax, Dartmouth do. And I was mystified by this, that I'd never heard about it. I was probably only 6 or 7, and I asked my mother about it. And she said that, indeed, it had happened, and that her mother, who lived 250 miles away, not only heard the explosion, but actually had cracks in the plaster of her house after that.
Wow. Well, it was not an event that I had heard of, and I'm sure there are probably, as I said, a lot of other people to whom this is going to be a new story. I would imagine at the time it must have been news everywhere.
It was news all over the world, including in Germany, which of course was, in the war, who wrote very interesting editorial saying that at least now North Americans would understand the kind of barrage that they had lived under and the sort of conditions that people were living under in Europe. Certainly was in the paper in the London Times and everywhere in the world, basically, because for a long time people weren't sure what had happened. It took a while to ascertain what exactly had exploded.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could set the scene. You can set the scene a little bit, because as the title of the book would suggest, indeed what happened did take place at a relatively narrow strait of water with the city of Halifax on one side and Dartmouth on the other. It was a shipping channel, and there were ships tied up on either side, particularly, I guess, on the Halifax side. There were a lot of ships. So sort of what's this territory look like?
Well, Halifax is a very important port on the eastern seaboard because it's the first and last dropping off point on the North Atlantic. At that time, it was very hard to make a crossing directly, and so people, American ships, all ships basically, would often make a drop off in Halifax before going on and pick up supplies or drop things off. Halifax Harbor has got hills all the way around it. And from the outer harbor, you can't tell. It looks like the harbor ends at the Narrows because it kind of crooks off a little bit to the left. And after that comes this beautiful round basin where hundreds of warships can hide. And that's what the French ship, which was carrying the high explosives, that's where it was headed, because there was a convoy waiting there to head to Europe, and it was trying to get into the basin so that it could be safe with the convoy.
Mm. This involved two ships. One of them was the ship, the Mont Blanc. This was the one that was loaded with the explosives. And then there was another ship called the Emo.
That's correct.
They were going in opposite directions and headed toward one another. So that's how it is that this happened. And yet, at the same time, and I know one of the things that you're talking about in the book was that there was an inquiry about what happened. It is relatively narrow, but I'm sure that ships go back and forth here all the time. Was what happened a matter of bad luck or bad seamanship, or why did the two ships collide? Certainly, well in advance of hitting, they saw one another.
Yes, it is, to this day, it is a bit of the mystery why the pilot of the Emo continued on the course that he did. And for years, many, many years, people speculated that it had been sabotaged by the Germans. In fact, it was probably a series of navigational errors that started with the fact that both ships failed to stop instantly upon seeing each other, because the Belgian relief ship coming out of the harbor was a little bit too much in the other lane. He was out of his lane because he had done a favor for an incoming ship and basically allowed him to pass on the wrong side. After that, there was a little bit of bad luck involved in that the Mont Blanc was the first ship filled with high explosives to come down that harbor since the war began, and probably the most heavily cargoed ship ever of high explosives to enter Halifax Harbor. That ship would be involved in a collision was a spectacular bad stroke of luck for Halifax. But basically, the two ships ended up a little bit too close. The Emo tried to back out, and because it was empty and it didn't follow its propeller, it couldn't really steer in the way that it would if it had been heavily loaded, and it grazed the Mont Blanc. And then the fuel that was on the deck caught on fire.
Yeah. And that is, I guess, in describing what happened, that in fact the two ships here, they were approaching one another, coming closer and closer and closer and closer, and actually they did manage to stop before they hit one another. It's not that this was a head-on collision.
That's right.
It's that they managed to stop just right about the point where they're right next together, and then the person who was at the wheel in command of the Emo says, okay, well, I have to back up. And he puts his ship into reverse, and then, as you say, what happened was it apparently, instead of just going straight backwards, it turned. And the nose of, that's not a very nautical term, the bow of the ship, just then, yeah, indeed. And then it just kind of scraped into the Mont Blanc, and that was it. That from there on, it was
downhill. Yeah, that's a beautiful description of it, David. Thank you. That's exactly what happened. And the and the bow did enter the Mont Blanc, probably, they think, between 9 and 12 feet, and it entered, and it crushed a little bit of high explosives. The difference between a regular explosive and a high explosive is that high explosive is set off by pressure. You could light a high explosive on fire in a field and nothing would happen to it. But if you condense it, if you drop it, then it will explode. And so there was probably, they took great, great care in New York where the Mont Blanc was loaded to make sure that there was no, you know, that the holds would not leak, that nothing could get at this cargo. But unfortunately, the bow coming in, there was probably just a couple of free grains would have been enough to set off that benzol on top of the bow.
Yeah, and it did. The explosion was not immediately after the collision. It was, I think, about 20 minutes or so.
About approximately 20 minutes. And what happened is the French crew knew that the ship was going to blow up, and they expected it to blow up instantly, so they just abandoned ship as soon as they could. They stopped the ship. They abandoned it, thinking that it would stay in the middle of the harbor. Unfortunately, as they were rowing away, the ship, as it starts to burn, starts to drift toward one of the busiest piers in the Halifax Harbor, just below a small neighborhood called Richmond. There's about 10,000 people live there. And people all over the neighborhood on both sides of the harbor were drawn to their windows and onto their verandas, into the streets, onto the, and even coming down as far as the docks themselves to watch this spectacular fire. The whole sky above the city was pink and green, yellow, blue, and the drums of oil on the bow of the Mont Blanc would fly up into the air 100 or 200 feet and then explode over the city. So as one fellow saw it, a military man said, it was the best damn fire I'd ever seen in my life. And then he was promptly knocked out by the concussion.
Yeah. As you say, this the ship, the Mont Blanc, was loaded to the gills with this high explosive, and no doubt was the most dangerous thing ever to sail down that strait. Who knew that? Was it widely known, in fact, that this ship did carry this dangerous cargo?
No, there were three people who knew. The person who checked the cargo when it was outside of the submarine gates. During the war, there are gates set up across the harbor so that submarines can't get in. That officer knew. The one other officer knew, and his assistant, basically. The captain superintendent was supposed to have known, and he later denied knowing, but it seems unlikely. Either if he didn't know, it was negligence, and if he did know, it was still negligence. But really, it was the one Canadian military officer who took the brunt of it.
Yeah. You would think that if it had been more widely known, that greater precautions would have been taken to make sure that this kind of thing didn't happen, as much as you could have tried to make sure that it didn't happen.
Well, one of the problems was that the harbor had been taken over by the Canadian military and then the British Admiralty. And there was confusion about who was, you know, in control of what a little bit. And basically, the British were very dismissive of the Canadians and didn't listen to them very much. The other problem is that in peacetime, that ship would have had a flag on it. But of course, because it was wartime, it had the option of flying the flag, but it would have been suicidal.
Yeah, it would have been just like hanging a sign on it that says,
"That's right.
Bomb me."
Right. One of the interesting things about the convoys, you know, they had just started it just shortly before America entered the war. One of the reasons they did it is because they found that the Germans would, it was very easy for them to just pick off ships as they were making a crossing. But if there was even one small destroyer with numerous ships, they wouldn't take on the fight. So one single ship, which was how the Mont Blanc left New York and sailed up to Halifax, there's no way that they would have had that flag on it.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Laura MacDonald. She is the author of the book Curse of the Narrows that's published by Walker & Company. It's just come out, and it does indeed tell the story of this disaster. This happened December 6th of 1917 in Halifax, Nova Scotia, when this ship, the Mont Blanc, that was loaded with high explosives destined for World War I, collided with another ship. There was a fire. It exploded, and it just devastated the area, Halifax and Dartmouth. Thousands of people were killed. More thousands were injured. I think you say in the book that there was not a single building in Halifax that was not somehow damaged by this explosion.
Yeah, that is correct. Every single building for miles and miles had either, you know, at the very least, broken windows or was completely demolished.
Yeah. We have a caller and somebody here who'd like to call in and get involved in the conversation. Other people who are listening can do that too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Caller is nearby in Belgium, and that's line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of questions. First off, couldn't they put the flag up just as they entered the harbor instead of all the way from New York? Obviously, that wouldn't be good. And second, there was a rather famous explosion in Texas City that was very, very large also and killed many thousands of people, too. Did that take place same time, different times? Or,
I believe the Texas explosion was quite a bit later.
Ah.
But I'm not completely sure, and I don't have that number in front of me, although I did look at some of the records about that.
And that one was a very, like...
That was also a very large, devastating explosion.
Fertilizer or something like that exploded?
Yeah, again, which would have been more in the category of a high explosive than just a regular munition sort of thing.
And about the thing about the flag?
Well, they could have, if they felt safe enough, but I don't... You know, the people were so nervous on the Eastern Seaboard, you know. I don't know if people realized how many things were being blown up. You know, even around New York, they had two huge explosions that were German sabotage already. The Germans had blown up a bridge between Maine and Canada. They were trying very hard to disrupt all of the shipping. Before America entered the war, they were trying very hard to disrupt all of the shipping going out of New York because a lot of those munitions were bound for Europe. And I think people were just very, very nervous. This captain was also inexperienced. He had never had high explosives on board. And basically what was happening was the governments in Europe and Canada as well were, you know, creating this merchant navy. And because there was just such a high-risk endeavor and things were so desperate, people weren't getting the training that they needed.
Seems to me you'd have to be an awful brave soul in any time to be in a ship full of ammunition.
You didn't have a choice.
Oh.
The government basically just forced them to do it, and that's what they were doing. And I think everybody was doing their part. There was a horrible war going on, and millions of French people were dead. So certainly that crew would have been interested in getting those explosives over to them.
Thank you very much.
All right,
thank you.
Well, just for the record, as they say, the Texas City disaster, this was April 1947.
Yeah.
And generally, according here to Wikipedia, I'm looking out on my computer here, generally regarded as the worst industrial accident in U.S. history. This was an ammonium nitrate explosion. More than 500 people were killed. So certainly very serious. But if you take a look at the destruction from what happened, what we're talking about, it was a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot more.
Well, the air blast from the explosion itself reached 13,000 miles an hour. That is very fast.
That's still, you know, when you talk about just physically describing what happened from the explosion, the kind of temperatures that were reached, it's just all, it's very difficult to imagine.
It is. I mean, it did reach a core temperature of 9,000 degrees Fahrenheit, enough that all of the salt water surrounding the bow of the ship evaporated for 20 feet. One of the interesting physical facts of this, and it's something that Oppenheimer later studied when he was looking at nuclear weapons, is what happens in an explosion when it's that close to water. And so when that water evaporated, it pulled all of the water off of the opposite shore. Now, as we know from the tsunami last year, that is, that's a symptom or a sign that there's going to be a tsunami. And that's exactly what happened in the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
The water came from the other shores and filled that gap, and then it, you know, rushed back, and it was a bit like dropping an ice cube into a drink, and, you know, ripples coming in and out, and it gathered into a 20-foot tsunami that went up to 60 feet above sea level, and it washed a lot of people out to sea. We'll never know all of the numbers, but one of the things we do know is that when the air blast went off, there was about a quarter mile cloud of fire that burst out over the city. And luckily, that tsunami also put some of those fires out immediately after. So it did have some benefit.
Yeah. So there was initial explosion. There was fire. There was incredibly high wind. There was, I'm sure, with that high wind, extremely high temperatures.
Yes.
And then on top of it all, there was a tsunami that was created by the explosion.
That's right. And then later that night, there was a blizzard.
That's as if this wasn't bad enough. That was the next thing that happened was a blizzard. 16 inches of snow. The temperature dropped, I think you say in the book, it dropped to 16 degrees. So here was this incredible devastation. There were still people trapped in the rubble. There were people who literally whose clothes were blown off of them. And then on top of all of that, then comes 16 inches of snow.
Yes, and Halifax is, you know, known for its lousy weather. And I have to say, when you tell that story, anybody in Halifax always just sort of rolls their eyes like, of course. The 16 inches of snow did really hamper the relief, and it also, and all the rescuers had to break pretty early. And the next day, although, you know, half the roads in the city were blown apart and the rail was very difficult, they had to open a new part of the railroad to get trains in the city. You just couldn't drive up the street. So the hills are you know, they're very, very steeply graded. It's like San Francisco, and you couldn't get a car up those snowy streets. So it was a big obstacle.
That's a remarkable story. And that is the story, again, Laura McDonald tells in her book, Curse of the Narrows. And we'll go on and we'll talk a little bit about the response to the disaster, the relief effort, the connection with the city of Boston, which is a kind of interesting one. If you'll bear with us here for a second, Laura, what we want to do is pause just long enough to remind people that this is going to be one of their last opportunities here, at least for Focus 580, to make a contribution to the station. And we'd like to just hear from as many people as possible who enjoy listening to Focus 580, other shows on WILL. And if you have not yet made a contribution, well, we really hope that you will do that and do that this morning. You can call us. You can go online. Whichever way, your contribution means a lot to us. Jack Brighton is the man who's behind our web effort here on WILL. He's here in the studio with me. And in Pledge Central, we have one of our documentary producers from WILL Television, Allison Davis Wood, standing by. So, what are we going to tell people here now to get them to go to the phone?
Well, this is the last chance that you have to support Focus 580 this week during our fall pledge drive. And we really want to hear from you if you enjoy the show, because you make it happen, actually, literally make it happen. About half of our funding comes from you, people listening to the show. So please give us a call right now, 217-244-9455, to express your support by making a pledge to support WILL. And Allison, I know we had a pretty busy first hour of the show this morning, but so far during the 11 o'clock hour, the last hour of the week for Focus 580, we've got a big goose egg going, I think.
Yeah, we do, but I know that we can pick it up because I often hear from so many people out in our community who really appreciate the access that David provides when he has these international, national, local people on the show that they can call in, they can ask questions. This is locally produced programming, and it's something that isn't cheap for us to do, but I know there's people out there that really appreciate it. And there are some folks in this community that appreciate it, and they show their appreciation with these challenges, and that includes the Marshak family. We need 9 more people to get to our number of 80 callers to get that extra $500 from the Marshak family. If you're listening right now, we'd really appreciate to hear from you at 244-9455. And also Professor Paul Deal, who is a fan of this program, will add an extra $250 if we can get 20 pledges this morning. And we need 11 more people to get to that challenge. So we've got a lot of money on the line. I know people are out there. They want to call. So let's hear from you.
That's right.
244-9455.
So we need 11 calls before noon for Focus 580, and I know we can do this. And you know what? We have to do it because this is how we fund this public radio operation here. If we weren't here, you really wouldn't have anything like Focus 580 to listen to. So it is important that we keep it going, and it's down to the line. If you've been waiting all week, you're saying, "Yeah, I'm going to do it. Okay, I know I'm going to pledge during Focus 580 because this is one of my favorite shows." Well, guess what? We're out of time. This is the last chance you have this week to support the show. So please give us a call. Again, the pledge line, 244-9455. It just takes about a minute of your time. Or you can go online to willpledge.org to make a pledge online with a credit card contribution or other options you have there. So please don't let this hour pass without you making a call.
All right. Thank you very much, Dave, Allison, and Jack. Let us continue our conversation here with Laura McDonald. She's the author of several books. She's also written and produced award-winning television shows, one feature film, and is the author of the book The Curse of the Narrows. It's published by Walker & Company, and it describes the events surrounding this explosion of the Mont Blanc. It was a ship. It was loaded with high explosives bound for Europe for World War I. This happened in December of 1917. It hit another ship. There was a fire. There was an explosion, and it devastated the city of Halifax, Nova Scotia. She grew up there in Halifax, so this was a story that she grew up with, at least something that she heard about when she was a girl. Although I expect probably for a lot of people listening, this will be their first time of hearing about this storm. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, ask a question, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to talk with, Champaign-Urbana, someone here local, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Any suggestions for improvements? Like in 1960, around Boston, two ships in the fog hit. They supposedly had radar. And in the Baltic a while ago, a ship went down because the bow door wasn't closed. So it seems like it's an easy thing to check the door or not to be moving in heavy fog.
Yeah. Well, a natural question would be, after this event, what changed, and were there any important changes that were made that would make it less likely that something like this would happen in the future?
Well, they did stop. They basically had a rule that any ship incoming with any sort of munitions or high explosives, particularly, would be, you know, escorted down the harbor, and there would be no outgoing ships whatsoever. In fact, although the two ships could have easily passed, much larger ships, the Olympic, which is a sister ship to the Titanic, had often passed large ships there. There was no problem in terms of space. But they did just take that precaution. I should say, though, when I was doing my research and talking to a lot of pilots, the men who bring ships into local ports, they pointed out the many, many accidents that happen, even in the high seas, just on the shipping lanes, and that most navigational magazines have a column devoted to accidents. They happen fairly regularly and for very small reasons. Things go wrong. My explosive expert said that when this sort of thing happens and something actually ends up, you know, exploding and there's an accident, it's usually not one thing that goes wrong. It's six or seven, and that was certainly the case with Halifax.
Yeah. More than 2,000 people died?
That's correct. Yeah.
And several thousands more were wounded.
6,000 were wounded and 9,000 homeless. And the neighborhood Richmond, which was the most badly damaged, there were only 10,000 people in that neighborhood. So that was pretty much obliterated.
There are also just some remarkable survivor stories of people who came through this and amazing things happened to them, and they lived to tell the tale.
Yeah, I follow quite a few people. There are some people who are only in the book for a short period, but they have a spectacular tale, like a guy named Charlie Myers, who is on the shoreline on another ship watching the fire. He was very nervous because he'd been in the war, and he knew that it was not going to end well. And the air blast picked him up, threw him to the top of the hill of Fort Needham in Halifax, and left him there unhurt, but naked except for one boot. And people in Halifax made terrible fun of him. No one would believe that this happened. But several other people also experienced the same thing. And basically what was happening was that the air blast was slowing down a little bit, and it just gently left him on the hill, you know, as it moved past. Certainly if the city had been flat, he would never have lived, and there would have been a lot more damage and a lot more deaths.
Yeah. It's really also one of the sad things is that a lot of the injuries happened to people who were simply standing and watching the fire, because, as you said, it was so spectacular. It obviously drew people's attention, and it took something like 20 minutes from the time that the collision occurred and the fire started to the explosion. So there were probably people all over who were just standing there watching. And if people were unlucky enough to be looking out a window when the explosion happened, there were a lot of people who had damage to their eyes from flying glass that was a result of the explosion, and them standing in front of the window and then getting caught when it blew up.
Yes. I mean, growing up in Halifax, the central image of the explosion in most people's mind is, you know, a woman and a child standing in front of a window watching. It was just before school was to start. Many kids were still at home. Some were in the streets, and some were already in their school, depending on which school they went to. And many of the doctors said that a lot of their patients were women with severe lacerations around the face. There were hundreds of people who woke up and couldn't see and were temporarily blinded. And then there were also people who were fully and partially blinded.
Mm. This was wartime. There was military barracks there. There were soldiers there. There were sailors there. How well prepared was the infrastructure there, the police and firefighters and medical and everybody that was concentrated there? How well prepared were they for this?
I think that they weren't prepared at all, except for the military, which is always prepared in some way. Because it was a military town, it made the relief effort a lot easier, and things got done faster. Basically, the military was in the streets within hours, handing out blankets. They had cordoned off that neighborhood, and they started immediately to look for rescuers. Unfortunately, the hospitals were completely overwhelmed with, you know, over 10,000 people showed up suddenly. And the hospitals, there were already so many doctors gone overseas that they were short-staffed. So that made it difficult. However, the city counselors and the took over and started immediately to try to organize something. And a couple days later, the American Red Cross arrived from Boston, as did a division of the Massachusetts Public Safety Committee. And they all got together to try to create a relief system that would work. And although there were many, many complaints, as there always are in any kind of a disaster or catastrophe, it did work. It was fairly effective.
Well, it does sound like, given just how serious an event this was and how much devastation there was, that it sounds like they did pretty well.
I think they did very well. I think they did do very well. One of the differences between a disaster and a catastrophe is what happens to the city's infrastructure. And in Halifax, it was, you know, it was wiped out. You know, in New York, we were very lucky in that the city could still function, and it allowed a very fast response. In Halifax, the very people who were trying to rehabilitate the city had actually lived through the explosion. So it did make things more difficult, but in the end, they did do a fairly effective job. And you know, the local doctors, they were in the hospitals for, you know, 30, 40 to 60 hours operating and trying to see patients.
How long did it take the city of Halifax to rebuild?
It took years. Yeah, although I should say they had temporary housing within weeks for people, and then they built that was a very short-term temporary housing that the military just started building within days after the explosion, and then they built a more permanent apartment complex, basically, where people could live while permanent houses were being rebuilt. And they redistricted the area a little bit. Interestingly, they allowed people to rent the permanent buildings, and then they offered them for sale fairly cheaply. And those people bought those houses, probably people who would have never been able to afford to buy a house. And that district of Halifax in the North End, when it went through hard economic times, was always in a little bit better shape than its neighbors, where everyone was allowed to rent. So converting those people to homeowners actually was very beneficial for the city.
Right after this happened, the appeal went out for aid, and certainly within Canada, particularly in, in New Brunswick, the parts of Canada that would be closest to Nova Scotia there did indeed send assistance. In what way did the government, particularly the national government of Canada, respond to this?
Well, what happened, one of the problems with Halifax is that they couldn't quite get the word out. And the telegrams went out on the railroad, just with people on the railroad, like the operators themselves, sort of hearing rumors. And so this batch of telegrams went out. Only one went out from the city itself. These kind of went up and down the telegram lines until finally one reached Ottawa. And it went to the military headquarters, and they just had a terrifically difficult time because the military lines were down as well, trying to ascertain what happened. Once they, you know, sort of had an idea of what it was, they immediately started to, you know, put together trains of goods, services, medical people, and try to make arrangements to ship them to bring aid to the city.
It's interesting that I guess it did take a little while. Even initially, after the shock of the explosion, people there in Halifax didn't know what happened, probably the first and natural reaction was that someone dropped a bomb on us. Well, not someone, the Germans. This was an attack. This was, after all, World War I. How did people even begin sorting out what exactly had happened?
Well, that's a fascinating thing, because even the people who watched the ship burn, when they came to, they were almost all knocked unconscious. When they came to, their immediate reaction, and this is on all of my research, everybody says the same thing. They went out and looked for the plane. They were trying to see the German plane that had finally reached North America and dropped the bomb on them. And it took, in some cases, days for people to find out that it had been a ship that had exploded. And, you know, to this day, people still believe that it was probably German sabotage. But, you know, people really could not understand that the ship had exploded or why it exploded. Part of the southern part of the city, which is, where the university was, more residential area, a little bit of a more affluent area, they didn't see what had happened, and so they were confused for a very long time. Mm. People were lucky if they ran into a military person who could tell them the truth.
You talked about the fact that once, when the collision occurred between the Mont Blanc and the Emo, the crew of the Mont Blanc, they knew what they had, and they knew that the ship was going to blow up, and they abandoned ship.
They did, but they were French, and so when they tried to tell people what was going to happen, people didn't understand.
It just, yeah, that's another one of the, it's just how bad luck and mistakes and things just pile, you know, that's another one of those examples of how things just pile one on top of another.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we were talking about the fact that there was an inquiry and there was a lot of finger pointing. I'm sure different people tried to blame different people and a lot of blame settled on the person who was there at piloting the ship, the Mont Blanc. If they had not abandoned ship and the ship had drifted over to the pier on the Halifax side, if they had actually been able to take the ship and perhaps steer it over to the Dartmouth side of the strait and over there where presumably there weren't as many, the big city was over on the Halifax side, presumably there weren't as many people living on the Dartmouth side, would that have made a difference in terms of how many people were killed and how much destruction there was?
It would have made a huge difference. Probably would have cut down the, it's hard to say, but my explosives guy felt it would have cut it in half in terms of what had happened to Halifax proper. But I have to say, if I were Frank Mackey, the pilot of the Mont Blanc, I don't know how I could have made that decision, who you're going to blow up. He wasn't a military man. It would have been a terrible, terrible decision to make. And although there was a lot of criticism for them abandoning ship, in their defense, they did think that it was going to blow up that second, and they felt that they were only trying to save their life.
He
didn't realize what effect they could have had.
I'm sure he would have felt his first responsibility, he would have felt, no doubt, would have been to the crew to try to get them off the boat.
Right.
And then you'd go from there.
That's right.
One interesting part of the story is indeed the connection between that formed as a result between Halifax and Boston, because there were folks in Boston, in Massachusetts, who loaded up the emergency disaster apparatus that they had, doctors and tents and equipment, and loaded it up on a train and decided that they were going to go to see what they could do.
Well, that's a fascinating story. When I decided to write the book, I wasn't sure if I wanted to write the book. I didn't think being from Halifax was a good enough story. And then I started to delve into these people that came from Boston, and I realized that this was a great story in its own right. And for 3 years, I've been telling people that disaster relief is an interesting thing, and now we're all learning about it. But basically, this was America's first disaster relief committee set up by the government. They had done it because the federal government was nervous about the Eastern Seaboard again. They thought that something might happen, and they had asked them to set up this a committee. And Massachusetts and New York were the only two states to do it. And they put together a group of private people and public people and kind of came up with plans for, what-if scenarios. There were bakers who had extra flour, so there would always be food. There was dairy farmers who had alternate routes into the city, so the children would always have milk. They had trained people. They had basically this very adept group of people who could respond very quickly. And by 10 o'clock that night, they had assembled the train. They had the American Red Cross on board, who had a lot of disaster relief experience. They'd been at the San Francisco earthquake and whatnot. They were just finalizing America's first first disaster handbook at the time. And they put this group of people on the train, and they set out by 10 o'clock that night. Unfortunately, they ran into the blizzard, which is another great story of the man in charge of it getting out and telling the men they had to dig their way through the snow, because if it was that cold there, what could it possibly be like in Halifax, where they knew there were wounded children and women. And the men, spent hours digging through the snow that the train could get through the mountain pass. And indeed, they arrived on Saturday morning and found the city. Usually in disasters, people exaggerate a lot. And when they arrived, they couldn't believe it. They said it was much, much worse.
Mm-hmm. Is there any sort of monument in Halifax that marks this at all?
There is. It's on Needham Hill Park. A woman had donated the bells of a church that had been destroyed, and the bells are there. And every year at December 6th at 9:04:35, they ring the bells. And from the top, they've cut a path through the trees that you see. You look down over the hill, and you can see basically at the bottom of the hill where the ship would have been and where it exploded.
Mm-hmm. What about this story fascinates you? And I suppose maybe that's a more general kind of question is, what is it about disasters that do have a way of fascinating us?
Well, I think it's fascinating to see what happens to society, for one thing. I think that we're relieved of a lot of societal norms that sometimes restrict us and bind us. Certainly, one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I lived through 9/11 and I realized that there was a pattern. And underneath all of the chaos, there was a pattern, and people react sort of in similar ways. And it's not always negative. There's a lot of, you know, the racial tension in New York just completely disappeared, as did the class tension in Halifax. And there were, you know, for some people, it was quite an exciting day. If you didn't have anybody who was hurt or injured, it was a day of great excitement that you could suddenly help out. As many of the students, many of the young boys did in Halifax, they, you know, started being delivery boys and started bringing food to families and acting as informational, you know, go-betweens. And so I think that it's a very special time in a society when everything is broken, and it's not always a negative thing. Hmm. That interested me. The idea that before, you know, 1906, we had nothing. There was no idea that we would ever be prepared for something in advance. I guess it's one of those things that I'd taken for granted. I was a bit surprised to learn that it was that short time ago.
Yeah. Well, Ed, as I mentioned maybe one or two times, you now live in New York, and your connection with this was having grown up in Halifax. So is it really the case that the experience of having been through 9/11 that was one of the things that led you to think about this and write about this? And without 9/11, there probably wouldn't be Curse of the Narrows?
That's absolutely true. In fact, a different editor in New York had asked me to write a proposal, and I'd read all the extant books about the explosion, and I sort of concluded that although not one told the whole story, they pretty much had the story down, and I didn't really need to tell it. It wasn't enough just to be from there. And then 2 weeks later, Lower Manhattan was devastated, and I did spend that day making the comparison between everything. And when Giuliani was on the television saying there would be no profiteering, I just had this epiphany that he had been prepared, and that there were all these people who were all prepared, and that they had briefed him, and that the city had this emergency control center. Just fascinated me, because that was a very big difference between, you know, what happened in Halifax and how prepared they were and what happened in New York. And of course, the relief in New York worked really very well, but there were a lot of similarities, right down to, you know, on Monday morning, we were running out of milk in New York, and it was a big problem. That was also a big problem in Halifax. You know, I knew pets would be abandoned. I knew that children wouldn't have a way to get home from school and sometimes would have to walk home by themselves, which, you know, in New York is difficult. And so all of those similarities made a very big impression on me that day. Mm. Right down to the, of course, looking out my window and seeing a huge cloud of smoke billowing over the city.
Yeah. The event here we're talking about, the event in the book, that's not all that long ago. Are there a lot of people that are still alive? Did you have the opportunity to talk with people who had witnessed this?
There are people who are alive. Most of them were children at the time. Mm. I tried to work as much as possible off of original interviews. Halifax immediately appointed a historian in the first week who spent the next months going around and interviewing everybody and cross-referencing things and checking off to make sure that everything was correct. I worked off a lot of those files and personal interviews. But there are people who were born, and certainly even when I've been promoting the book, people have come up to me and said, you know, my aunt is in a home and I'm going to buy this book for her because she lived through it.
Hmm. I like that idea that the city no doubt felt this was an important thing for history, for their history and anybody else's, that they actually would have appointed somebody to, as events were unfolding, in a sense, to record those events.
I think it's a beautiful idea, and I have to say on 9/11 I was like, they have to appoint somebody. I was obsessed with the idea, and of course they did. And they did it at Columbia University, and they collected many, many stories. And it's a wonderful thing, and it's one of the things that I think is very important in the days that can get lost. Mm-hmm. But Halifax did it. I mean, it's an old-fashioned town, and it immediately knew that this was going to be something and that they had to record it properly.
You talked about the fact that there are some amazing stories, experiences that people had, amazing survivor stories, like the man who was picked up by the force of the explosion and then blown far from where he had been and set gently down with only one boot left. It took off all of his clothes, and he had to beg some clothes and shoes off somebody. There must be other stories like that. Are there particular stories that are so amazing, those kind of stories that you think if you were writing a novel and you wrote this, people would say, "Now, isn't that going a little bit far?" And yet, there are things that actually happened.
There are many things like that, and I mean, I think one of the things that anybody who reads the book will see that how impressed I am with the children, how fast acting, how fast thinking they were, and very no nonsense, and many times saved their own families. There's a young girl, Helena Duggan, who has the school collapse on top of her. She drops through two floors, climbs out of the rubble, immediately thinks of her family at home, runs home, finds her sister in the yard screaming. Her older sister is hanging off of a post by her arm. The soldier won't let her in the area, and she tells him that this is her sister. And he rushes off to save her sister, and she digs her mother and her brother and two sisters out of the rubble and then takes them up to the hospital. She was 7 years old.
Wow, that's astonishing. Does that have something to do with the fact that it was wartime? Does it have something to do with the fact of what time it was in history? Does it have something to do with the fact that it was Canada and it was a relatively small city? And how do you account for that?
I think that, well, first of all, I think children are amazing and we underestimate them. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's just you do what you have to do in those times and you do not have time to panic. You know, people have this idea that when there's a disaster, people panic. People don't panic. People become very calm, and they become if there's a threat of another explosion or whatever, then they might panic. But for the most part, people become very unified and very they concentrate a lot on trying to be helpful. And it's like one of those things I said that is becomes a positive part of the disaster.
Yeah.
I do think part of it is Nova Scotia character. We're very no nonsense. Straightforward, and we're not, we're used to the life cycle. So, death and destruction is part of our history. We're proud of that.
Well, it's a remarkable story, the book is Curse of the Narrows, and it's full of that kind of story. And if this is something that's new to you, and I'm sure a lot of people were saying, well, I've never heard about that event, the events that took place in December of 1917 in Halifax, Nova Scotia, look at the book. It's Curse of the Narrows, and it's published by Walker & Company, is out now. Laura McDonald, she now lives in New York City, but she grew up in Halifax. Ms. McDonald, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David.
Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast today is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Now is the time for you to do that. One last time here this week, here on Focus 580, I can encourage you to go to the phones and give us a call, make a pledge of financial support to the station. You can do that by calling 244-9455. 217 is the area code. You can also go online at willpledge.org, whichever way you want to do it. Perhaps it's been one of those things on your list to do this week. Make a pledge to WILL, and you haven't quite got to it yet. Well, now is the time, because the time is running out here this week. If we're going to make our goal, we need to hear from as many people as possible, and you can help us meet some short-term goals here that we have set, some challenges, and also that overall challenge of keeping WILL strong. Let's talk one last time here during Focus 580 with Allison Davis. She is documentary producer downstairs here, WILL-TV, and she is in Pledge Central.
Yes. Hi, David. We have a lot of money on the line right now. This is our last break in Focus 580, and we have two challenges that we would like to meet. We only need seven more callers to reach that $500 challenge from the Marshak family. So seven calls. I know we can do that. There's seven people out there, I'm sure, that are listening that haven't called in yet this week and want to call in at 244-9455 to tell us how much they appreciate the great programming on AM 580. And also, Professor Paul Deal, we can have $250 extra dollars for our programming here at WLL if we can hear from only 10 more people this break. So go to the phone, 244-9455. People are always telling me how much they appreciate the locally produced programming here on AM 580 with David and with Celeste. And this is the time for you to go to the phones and show your support. This is the last weekday of our radio fund drive. And it's very important that we hear from you, maybe at the $40 level.
That would be great if people are going to make their contribution for the first time. They're sort of asking, well, all right, how much are you talking about? Well, that would be a place to start, the basic membership level, $40. And that will get you, among other things, a year subscription to Patterns, our program guide. Maybe you can do the $75 level, and that you can get the member card, which is something a lot of people enjoy. They get discounts at a lot of restaurants and other nonprofits, not only around Illinois, but in fact all around the country. But I think that we know that people, well, it's not just about the program guide. It's not about the member card. It's not about a coffee mug. You know, it's about supporting a service that you value. It's very important. Almost half of the money now that pays for the programs here on WILL has to come from listeners. And we want you to do your part. If you've never made a contribution before, now's a great time. 244-9455. That's the number you can call. It will take a minute or two only, and then we'll have you on your way, and you will go knowing with that good feeling that comes from knowing that you are a supporter of the station that you value. 244-9455, or you can go to willpledge.org. Well, that's about it here, folks, 580 for this week, but we want you to stay tuned. There'll be much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host. In the 1 o'clock hour today, you'll be talking about Ben Franklin.
Right, and we're going to talk about Ben Franklin's scientific work, especially his experiments with lightning and electricity. Our guest will be Philip Dre. He's the author of Stealing God's Thunder, Benjamin Franklin's Lightning Rod, and the Invention of America. Philip Dre will join us at 1:06. That's after the newscast at 1 o'clock from National Public Radio. Let's take a look at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade. Prices are lower. December wheat trading at 328¾, down 3½. March 342¾, down 4. December corn 201¼, down 1½. March 214, down 1½. May 222¼, down 1½. And December corn 246¾, down 1. November soybeans 573¼, down 11¾. January 585¼, down 12¾. March 593½, down 12¾. November beans 607½, down 11. December soybean meal 169.10, down 280. December oil 23.53, down 45. October feeder cattle 115.65, down 120. October live cattle 88.40, down 85. December lean hog 60.92½, that up